8th January 1980. Okay, this is talking with Ron Bracewell, continuing on 8th January 1980. On the Fourier transform business a bit more, I've talked with many people from the Cambridge group about its influence on their work, and they all ascribe a strong influence to Ratcliffe's course on Fourier transforms. Did you take that course, and if so, or did you see its influence on their work?
Well, yes. Ratcliffe had given this course, a short course of lectures, maybe only as many as 5 lectures, for a number of years running. And I possibly took it about the third go-round, maybe just the second time round, but I think it had been given once before anyhow. And after I had been through it, in some subsequent year, someone took notes, and then after that, the notes began to circulate. Mm-hmm. I never saw those notes, but someone at Manchester, I forget who now, almost published them. And in fact, later, it was published as a book, but with an acknowledgement in it. It very nearly got published without an acknowledgement. The others will have told you that story.
No, I haven't heard. It's a book by Ratcliffe.
No. Ratcliffe never wrote it up, you see.
Oh, I see. This guy that took the notes.
But someone took notes.
I see.
And they were reproduced for use of other students.
Right.
Must have been on a random basis, as such things are. And then someone, one of the well-known names, only it just doesn't come back to me at the moment, very nearly published them. And then someone discovered this, and there was a protest of some kind, and it was held up. But I think they ultimately were published with a proper acknowledgement. So Ratcliffe did indeed give half a dozen lectures. Now, I believe he got his knowledge. He was also a non-mathematical person, I should tell you. Very noticeably so. That's not to say that he didn't know a lot of mathematics.
Yes, no, I know.
But he did not sit down and solve things mathematically. He thought them out very carefully. And once he'd thought it out, he could write it in mathematics. I believe he got his knowledge of Fourier transform from the crystallography group in the Cavendish. There were people in the Cavendish, Bragg, for instance, who understood three-dimensional crystallography and the diffraction patterns very intimately. They understood that at a very intimate level, having started in the same way that Pawsey started. You know, Pawsey started with cosine responses to a point source, and the people in crystallography started with diffraction, Bragg diffraction from regularly spaced atoms.
Right.
And they understood that at a very intimate level, and then it became very, very complicated. But you could still understand that if you had lived through the subject. So somehow or other, Ratcliffe had picked up this mathematical type of knowledge, which was unusual for him. But his method of explaining it was entirely physical. What for you and me these days would be the shift theorem of the Fourier transform, for him was a prism.
Mm-hmm.
And a cosine, which we think of as having a transform which is 2 delta functions, to him that would be a statement that a cosinusoidally modulated screen up in the ionosphere would transmit 2 plane waves.
Oh, yes.
At angles of incidence to the normal, given by the spatial frequency of this corrugation.
Right.
So everything had an optical interpretation, and would then, but the purpose of these lectures was to facilitate the explanation of ionospheric phenomena.
Did you see at all the influence of this course on the work of Weil's group, or?
Yes, Now, let me see. No, the ionosphere, there were many ionospheric projects, all of which were influenced by that work. But the influence on the radio astronomy. Well, yes, the first example one could mention would be Stanier's attempt mm-hmm. as a graduate student, research student, to measure the intensity distribution over the sun by making simple interferometric measurements with trifling antennas
right.
in different azimuths and different spacings over some length of time.
Right, I believe that was the first direct use of these kind of principles, but you do see that as sort of coming out of Radcliffe's course
understanding? Don't doubt that at all.
Yeah. Did this course have a strong influence on you, or were you sort of a Fourier freak before you went to Cambridge even?
I did know a lot about Fourier analysis because I'd done my mathematics in a department which had grown up under Carslaw, who wrote one of the great texts in the subject. And although Carslaw had just retired at the time I began as a student, all his colleagues were the people from whom I learnt mathematics, which was a very rigorous ordeal in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew quite a lot about the subject, but I had none of the physical interpretation of that. The only interpretations ever given by the mathematicians were in terms of synthesizing waveforms.
Mm-hmm.
But these waveforms were not physical waveforms.
Right.
They would say, take a sawtooth waveform. Well, that was not the output from any oscillator.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it was an eye-opening experience to me to find Radcliffe able to interpret all these things in physical terms and to exhibit the ability to reason in terms of physics with mathematical problems. You take the mathematical problem, you translate it into physics, do the reasoning physically, translate the answer back, and you've got a mathematical theorem.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him going to a talk at which van der Pol explained how a lightning flash in between two conducting planes would lead in the distance where dispersion would have taken place to a waveform that was a J naught Bessel function.
Mm-hmm.
And he had proved this by some incredible integral that was well beyond the abilities of anyone in the Cavendish. And Radcliffe came back and reported this to us and very cleverly proved that he already knew this in terms of multiple reflections arriving at the same receiving point with appropriate time delays, and he was able to derive the asymptotic formulas for the Bessel function in very simple physical terms. When you wait for a long time, this Bessel function has become a very slowly decaying sine wave, and that, of course, is just due to multiple reflections which are more or less now vertical. And so the time delay up and back gives you the asymptotic period, and you can get the inverse dependence on time from, if I had a moment to think, I'd tell you the whole thing.
Well,
but it was quite
anyway,
a revelation of its kind, how something that was mathematical, to him he looked at sort of scornfully. He admitted you could integrate this out, but he would take the attitude, well, why do that when it's apparent?
Mm-hmm.
If you think that it would be so.
Is it fair to say then that this kind of attitude of Radcliffe had a strong influence on you?
Oh, indeed.
Certainly your textbook on Fourier transforms is just, the beauty of it to me is its physical insights.
Well, I hope you'll buy a copy of the second edition. Yes, and I've got my debt to Radcliffe clearly stated in the preface. And as a matter of fact, I sent Radcliffe a copy of the book, and he wrote back and said that he had been thinking of writing it up himself now that he'd retired, but since I had done the job, he would put his efforts into a couple of other books that he had in mind.
Well, going back to the post-war period, when was it you went to Cambridge again?
1946.
Okay, so it was very early in the middle of these solar observations.
Yes.
Was there anything else that you wanted to comment on about what you saw before you left?
A comment about polarization. I know that Pawsey did not go out with the intention of measuring polarization. That was done by D.F. Martin at Mount Stromlo, where Woolley was the director at the time. So while there was a little chuckling this morning when it was mentioned that Woolley had been chairman of Commission 40 of the IAU, he did have some credentials, at least through being administrative head of a place where the polarization of radio waves from the sun was demonstrated by D.F. Martin by a very clever polarimeter that might not have occurred to everybody.
Now, Martin, of course, I can't talk to. I didn't realize that he didn't build instruments, did he? He was a theorist.
He built instruments.
He did,
yes.
I didn't realize that.
I walked into his office at Mount Stromlo one day, and he had a chart recorder running on the wall, which was measuring the diurnal component of atmospheric pressure. And he had done this by connecting a barometer to a bottle stuffed with cotton so that the air could only get in and out very slowly with a time constant of about a day. As a result, the barometer was rising and falling with all the weather components filtered out, and only the diurnal, and I'm not sure whether this is lunar or solar diurnal, it must be the solar component. I think it may have
a nice tuned filter.
That's exactly right. Well, it's not tuned, it's just a low-pass filter. And he was recording that. Suppose you had a barometer rising and falling. How would you record the height? Well, he was doing that by shining a light on the meniscus and with photosensitive paper behind.
Beautiful.
Who knows what it was doing, but it sure as hell was drawing a line.
Right.
And here it was, with various amplitudes, various phases, running on and on and on. So he had instrumental ability. But in the case of the polarimeter, he had thought out how to do it. First, he'd conceived the notion. I don't know how that came about. But having got the notion in his mind, wouldn't this radiation be polarized? If so, let's look. He said, well, he must have looked for linear polarization first. I don't recall that. But he must have rotated a dipole or a Yagi. And he could do this with a single antenna. You see, this could be done with a single Yagi antenna. And he must have rotated it and not found any linear polarization. So he said, let's look for circular. And he did that by making a T-junction in coaxial cable, flexible cable, making one branch a quarter wavelength longer than the other, and connecting these two branches to two Yagi antennas, and then simply mounting them at right angles and moving one of them backwards by hand until it was a quarter wavelength behind the other to see what that did. Then he could move it a quarter wavelength in front. And he was able to show that there was strong circular polarization. And I don't remember whether he got the sense correct or not, but at least he knew how to do it. It's one of those subjects where you have to make an even number of errors to get it right.
And of course, that result of his was published along with two other reports of detecting polarization in the sun by Pawsey and by Hay. Or was it? I'm sorry, by Hay and by Ryle. And I guess I gather then that from your knowledge that Martin's thing was just completely independent.
Oh, it was certainly quite independent. And
they were all together in Nature within a couple of weeks.
I don't recall that, but if you go back and look at the dates of submission and so on, you might find out an interesting sequence of events.
Right.
It might have been an artificial synchronization.
No, that's true. That does happen sometimes. I don't remember in this case if it did or not.
As a matter of fact, you're beginning to stir my mind there that this may be one of those dubious cases. Well, we'd have to check into that to know, but you could easily find out.
So you went off to Cambridge to get a PhD, basically, I guess.
Yes.
And why did you choose to go into ionosphere?
Well, I went in to see Ratcliffe when I arrived, and he had in his hand a letter of recommendation that Bowen had sent to him. Bowen had been favourably inclined to the idea of my going on leave from radiophysics to Cambridge, so he had written a letter, and in typical Bowen fashion, he asked himself what he should write that would ensure the success of this mission. So he you'll see what he wrote. Ratcliffe said to me he was very glad to have me there, and he noticed all the good things that I had done, and he was particularly pleased that I had had some previous experience with the ionosphere. Now, I am a very naive person. I've learnt, but basically I'm a very naive person. So instead of using my brain, I immediately said, I have no experience with the ionosphere. And a frown crossed his face and his brow furrowed, and he picked up this letter and he looked at it again very intently. And he said, it distinctly says here, and I think he probably read me the sentence, and Bowen had perjured himself, saying that this man had previous experience with the ionosphere. My interpretation is that the purpose was very simple. Get the chap over there, they won't send him back. So Ratcliffe seemed worried about that, and he must have filed that away for future reference. He never mentioned it to me again. And then he said, we have several projects that might be of interest to you, and he described three. And since I was there a little earlier than some of the other newly arriving research students, I got first choice. Now, I had the choice of doing something that was a relatively high frequency, but I forget what. Now, I had been working in microwaves right at the very end of the radio spectrum, and as the radio spectrum had moved up to higher frequencies, I had done so too. So I'd been working on the fringe of the spectrum for a long time. Then he had some intermediate frequency thing at 2 or 3 megahertz. And then he had a project at 18 kilohertz. 16 kilohertz. That's the frequency of the transmitter at Rugby. And I thought, well, I'm accustomed to working at the end of the spectrum. This is the low end, so I'll go there. That was my principle for choosing. I knew nothing whatever about the type of work involved. Turned out to be very interesting.
But there was no choice outside ionosphere work. Because of this letter, I guess.
Well,
Ryle's group.
No, I had applied to Ratcliffe's group on Pawsey's recommendations. Pawsey knew Ratcliffe. We didn't know Ryle. Ratcliffe, everyone knew, was a great man, and of course he's the producer of Ryle in a real sense.
Right.
So Ryle didn't wasn't known at that time.
Well, can you briefly tell me what your work was at Cambridge, and in particular, what influence it may have had on later radio astronomy that you did? I say briefly because it's not directly radio astronomy, I gather.
Well, most of my previous experience had been with instruments, either with electronics or with waveguide equipment, microwaves. I became deeply familiar with microwaves and electromagnetic boundary theory problems that go with that. My experience then at Cambridge for the next 3 years was entirely in observational work.
Mm-hmm.
The planning and executing of observations, and, as it happens, building the necessary equipment, which was quite arduous and explains why one gets by with the minimum equipment. When you have to build it yourself, you think very hard, what's the minimum will do it. If you have to order it, and it's just a matter of paying money, you'll do it a more complicated way. So I learnt there how to plan observations and think out observations in terms of equipment. That was a new sort of experience for me. That was couched entirely in terms of ionospheric measurements and rather simple electronics. But the measuring problems were very delicate and interesting. I also then began picking up solar influences, and that caught my interest because I had had some background interest in astronomical things. And when I found that we could see the sun when we were picking up a radio transmitter, I became interested in that, and Radcliffe wasn't very impressed by that. He regarded that as a mild aberration and a diversion from my true duties.
You could see the sun with what kind of a receiver?
With a 16 kilohertz receiver tuned to a transmitter about 90 kilometers away. The effect is that there's an interference between the ground ray and the once reflected sky wave.
Mm-hmm.
And since the wavelength is about 19 kilometers, if the ionosphere happened to move down just a few kilometers, then the two vectors that are combining would show a change in resultant amplitude.
I see.
So that we could monitor movements of the reflecting level as small as a kilometer and probably less. This is a very sensitive detector. We could see the effects of solar flares, which were much too weak to be detected as fade-outs
directly
on short wave.
But they could be detected directly by the existing even?
No. Not at all. And as for a comparison with the spectroheliograph, we were in direct communication with Ellison, who was the only person observing flares in Great Britain, and we would send him lists of flares, none of which he could see unless they were very big.
Hmm.
For a long time, he resisted the notion that we could detect flares that he couldn't see, but whenever he got a thundering big one, we would send him the record, and ours would be colossal. So.
Right.
So we had a very sensitive technique for that.
Mm.
And the first paper I wrote, based on work I did in England, appeared in the monthly notices with my colleague Tom Straker on observations of of flare effects on very long waves.
Mm.
So there was a slight astronomical connection there. Otherwise, that work was
geophysics.
You could call it geophysics. Yes. Yes.
What about your relationship now with the Ryle Group? You were telling us at lunch about the Saturday morning.
Yes, the
club or whatever.
Yes, we would meet on Saturday mornings with all the radio astronomers and all the ionomers, and we would do various things. People would report on journal articles, or they would report on work that they themselves had just done, or there might be a discussion on some topic that had been circulating. Instrumental problems that people were engaged on,
mm-hmm.
how you would do this or how you would do that. One fellow was trying to make a machine for computing autocorrelation functions. There was an instrument somewhere which was churning out data on punched paper tape, and must have been the intensity of some downcoming wave from the ionosphere, or it might have been a phase. I think it was probably an intensity. Problem was, what's the autocorrelation function? And a great machine was built into which you fed this tape, and by banks of relays and other incredible telephone mm-hmm. equipment, it would remember a hole that had gone by and then multiply it by another hole. This is a total analog device, looked like a Heath Robinson machine. That sort of machine would be bandied about in discussion,
mm-hmm.
and people would argue about whether it was the right way to do it.
Right.
And usually they'd conclude that it was not a good way, and then the man would go away determined to prove them wrong and make it work over the weekend.
Yes.
Come back next week and see, I told you so. Nothing like a little competition like that to stimulate activity.
So Ryle's group at that time would be only one of many in the under Radcliffe?
No, Radcliffe lived in the old Cavendish, the old original
right.
building where the neutron had been discovered, and so on and so on. And the nuclear and X-ray people had moved into the new building. So the ionospheric people and the radio astronomers were all in a sequence of rooms on the first floor, and so we were all in very intimate contact.
And the ionospheric group was pretty much one group, and then the radio astronomers were the second.
Yeah, there was a noticeable division there because Ratcliffe was directing all of us, and Ryle was in charge of the other.
Right, right.
It's not that Ratcliffe was nominally in charge of the whole thing, but the de facto separation was quite clear.
Mm-hmm. And what about, were you in frequent contact with the early students under Ryle, or colleagues like Smith and...
Oh, yes, I...
And who was that fellow that worked with him? Von Berg.
Von Berg, yes, I knew Von Berg. Von Berg graduated and took a job in industry, if not with the post office, I forget which. And I remember us all feeling that was a sort of traitorous thing to do. Oh, here's a scientist, just goes and gets a job, throws away all his abilities for the benefit of mankind.
Right.
So Graham Smith was came along. I'm sure he came along a year or two after I did. We all knew one another very well.
But you did not take part in discussions with them about the meaning of the results they were finding? Or...
Oh, yes, they would discuss that on Saturday mornings, yes. I don't believe there was any air of secrecy at that time that in any way compares with what later developed.
I see. This business about Von Berg is interesting. I haven't been able to track him down in England, but was that a bit of a setback to Ryle's group? I mean, that was sort of half the staff that he had gotten trained, more or less, and all of a sudden it's gone.
Well, Von Berg was a tall, rather striking fellow, rather imposing, and it's conceivable to me now, though I don't know for sure, that there might have been an element of competition between the two of them, and that may have accounted for them splitting.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt whether it represented any substantial loss to the activity. I very much doubt that. I've since, like yourself, I've never heard of Von Berg since. I don't believe that he had anything like the scientific capacities that Ryle had. I really don't know. That's
right.
Just a guess.
Yeah. What about, once again, at lunch today, you were talking about how you became in correspondence with the people in Sydney about what was going on, and would sort of stand up at these Saturday mornings. Can you sort of repeat what your role was there?
Well, when I arrived in Cambridge, I found they regarded the work in Sydney as extremely backward, and I perceived immediately that this resulted from about an 18-month delay in information. When I left Sydney, I saw advanced things being done, and then when I arrived in Cambridge, it seemed to me about the same, different but similar state of development, whereas their attitude was that, based on what they had just read published, that they were well ahead of the competition and no danger of being overtaken. Well, it wasn't like that at all. And so I tried to disseminate a little information from Sydney, and I published two or three short letters to the observatory based on information that came through from Sydney with the approval of the management.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I told them what I was up to, and tried to close that gap. I felt very idealistic. I suppose when you're young you do, and I felt that a freer flow of information was a blow struck against entropy, and one had a duty to do it.
Right, and in fact, the first three publications here on my list are Observatory 1950 through 53, in which you're talking about Payne-Scott and Little's three-element interferometer to locate bursts, radio stars or radio nebulae, based on Piddington Minutes and Mills' observations, and then Mills Cross. But this radio stars or radio nebulae, it seems to me from reading that paper that it's more your synthesis of some information that they had sent you. Is that correct? I mean, you had more of yourself in that one. It wasn't just a reporter.
Well, I was trying to behave like a reporter, but to also I have an interest in exposition. I like to try to explain things to other people, and so well, I'd have to look at it again to see just exactly what you're referring to, but that sounds about right. Yeah. I would be trying to explain it a little better than the originators explained it. Mm-hmm. That's I think my description of the Mills Cross would be in that category. It's not quite a good description, which anyone can understand, and it's not original. I'm sure that Mills looked at it the same way, but whether he got it written up, I would have to look into the papers. But it was a good explanation of the Mills Cross, and I tried to put that into the record.
Now, it seems like, from what you said, then, that the Cambridge people, the Sydney people, were willing to send you this information, so that they were not fearful of...
I think that must have been written from Sydney after I got back.
It's 53 is the date on it.
Yes, well, I would have been back in Sydney then.
But when you were in Cambridge, there was no problem in...
Well, there were communications taking place. I don't know who Pawsey might have been writing to. But Ruby Payne Scott was certainly writing to Ryle. Well, now that I've said that, I believe that's another way of saying that that was Pawsey's way of communicating with Ryle. I know from other examples, for instance, Pawsey communicated with Reba by having me write. And so this would have been his way of communicating with Ryle.
Why does he use this technique?
Well, I tell you the Reba story first.
Okay.
Reba was on top of Maui.
Right.
And he was getting a little fed up with the circumstances there and had discovered that there's a hole in the ionosphere over Tasmania which nobody else knew. Well, it was known because it was in the books, as a matter of fact. But no one you met in the course of casual conversation knew that Tasmania was any different from any other equal southern latitude or southern magnetic latitude.
Right.
But sure enough, here's this hole over Tasmania, having something to do with the structure of the geomagnetic field, I suppose, but nevertheless. Well, Reuben had found that it would be the best place for him to peer through and that Maui wasn't as good as he'd hoped. So he wrote to Pawsey asking for assistance in setting up an installation in Tasmania. He wanted the radio physics lab to back an ionospheric venture. Well, it was quasi-ionospheric because he had in mind that he'd be able to peer through this hole and look at the galactic radiation from beyond. There'd be terrible problems of refraction, but it's a clear, original idea, typical vintage Reber. No one else had thought of it, and if they had, they wouldn't have given it a try. So it perplexed Pawsey because, although there were resources available, he wanted to expend these resources in the most scientifically productive way. A very cost-effective type of thinking he used to go through. But he didn't want to offend Reber by turning him down. So what he did was also typical vintage Pawsey. He gave this to some rabid reviewer, who, in this case, happened to be me. So, said, what do you think about this? Take it away and read it. So I read it through, and I found three or four things that were wrong. It was just not right.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Pawsey and gave him a little list. It was the sort of reviewing that one does on a paper.
Right.
The first comment, this is all wrong. The second comment, this is very dubious.
Right.
The third comment, this is jumping to a conclusion which is not substantiated. I was not taking a global view because it was not my responsibility to make a decision to commit funds or to embark on a new program. I was reading that paper in a microscopic proofreading type of way, so I gave Pawsey my list of comments, most of which were negative, as far as I can recall. And Pawsey then responded to Reba by sending him my handwritten list of nasty remarks. So I discovered years later that Reba never forgot this. In case what I'm telling you now leaks out, I won't report how I found out that Reba never forgot it, but I can't blame him.
Yeah.
So
this is how you ended up writing Reba.
That's right. I never wrote the letter. And as a matter of fact, Pawsey is not the person who told me that he sent this piece of paper.
Oh, not even that.
I discovered this in a most indirect fashion, to say the least. Well, in any case.
And what about with Payne Scott and Ryle?
That would have been Pawsey's way of communicating with Ryle. He would say to Ruby, why don't you write to Ryle about this? And she would write the letter, show it to him, I'm imagining, and he would say, you could also point out. And she would send the letter. Now, she was a pretty tough cookie, and she would write a non-diplomatic letter. All her speech and conversation were non-diplomatic, verging on rude. And so these letters to Ryle, I think one can guarantee, were of the nature, I told you so, or
right.
I told you so last time, and, you know, only a fool would believe that. And I'm sure they were very offensive letters, but quite in her style, normal everyday style. And Ryle had corresponded with her, and the argument they were having was over the existence of sporadic bursts. Now, when Ryle had put a lot of emphasis on the fact that you had to have a loudspeaker attached to your solar recordings because hearing them permitted you to distinguish the signature of non-solar phenomena, most particularly vehicles rumbling down the road. You could hear them coming and you could become acquainted with the sound, and you would watch the chart recorder pouring out, and if you heard ignition noise from a truck going by, you would write that on the chart recorder. Then an airplane would go overhead at the same time as there'd be a little burst, which of course would be of much shorter duration, just a spike on the record, because the plane was only there for a brief time. So Ryle knew how to identify airplanes. But Ruby also knew airplanes. They weren't as numerous in Australia, of course. So she knew she had things that were not airplanes, which she called sporadic bursts or isolated bursts. And Ryle had never reported these, or perhaps he had published a record showing one, and she'd written to him saying, this is an isolated burst, and he had written back saying, it's an airplane. So they'd had a couple of interchanges on this, and then when I got back to Sydney, I had some of Ryle's records with me, and Ruby immediately pounced on these and said, there they are, and she probably wrote him a letter saying, I told you so, there are these bursts all the time, you see.
These were the records that you had looked at in connection with your ionospheric work. Apparently Ryle had let you...
Yes, I needed to make a correlation study between sudden phase anomalies due to solar flares and bursts of solar noise that occurred at the same time. And I have here with me a Xerox copy of one of these records that I'm referring to.
From March 47.
This jagged curve is the solar chart made by Ryle. It's full scale and hand traced. That's a hand tracing of which I made considerable lengths. It's the 29th of March 1947.
Of his original record?
Yes.
Right.
And as you can see, there are two important bursts, and then there's things are quiet. And then there's a post-burst increase that runs on for quite a long time.
A half an hour.
Coming later. Then the smoother curve is our record of what the ionosphere was doing. Mm-hmm. The ionosphere went down and then recovered slowly. It's a very uniform thing. And undoubtedly this follows quite closely the integrated ultraviolet from the flare,
mm-hmm.
because it's quite in keeping with the visible observations made with spectroheliograph. We have many cases of the line width measured with the spectroheliograph agreeing in the general profile
right. With
this. Of course, the visible ones generally started when the flare was near a maximum, because that's the first time they'd see it. So our sudden phase anomalies always began before the optical observations. But as you can see from the second example I have here, we have a case where possibly the solar noise sets in
before
a few seconds,
yep. Or
maybe a minute or two, before the phase anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the sort of analysis I was doing, and all I can say is that the situation was then as it is now. The solar noise is a very irregular thing compared with the general course of the flare itself.
But your sin was in showing these tracings to him.
Yes. Now, Ryle knew I was making these because he had them filed in drawers in his office, and I was there for days laboriously tracing these on long rolls of tracing paper, searching through my list of times and dates,
mm-hmm.
finding his record, and if there was something interesting, as in these two cases, I would trace his whole record. Here you
right.
can see, by the way, the interference pattern of his two-element interferometer. That's all
mm-hmm.
superimposed on
right.
this. And quite possibly this diminution may be an interferometric minimum. But you can see that there was a sudden cessation of noise, but perhaps that minimum, which looked kind of round, we can tell by the timing, you see. That's probably an interference minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So you need skill to read those records,
right.
nevertheless. And these things here are quite possibly sporadic bursts. There are several of them. They're probably type 3 bursts, and the kind of thing that were in contention.
It would occur to me that if this was one of his main early correspondents in Sydney, that this may have been something that turned him off to Sydney. This kind of treatment from this Australian woman.
Oh, that's possible.
I just don't know. Well, the next publication I have in your list is, I guess actually there's one other before we get to your textbook. Bracewell and Roberts, 54. When did you go back to Australia now?
In 1950.
Oh, in 50. Oh, I see. So, well, then the question is, before we get to 54, what things did you start working on?
Well, for 2 years, I did ionospheric measurements in Australia, similar to those I'd done in
Rising.
England. As a matter of fact, I made very long-wave observations on the boat on the way back to Australia.
Stopped working.
I had a little room up on the bridge and an inverter, and I made observations of GBR for thousands of miles. And then I continued that sort of work in Australia, working with Keith Bigg, who later became famous for discovering the control that Io exerts over the Jupiter radiation.
That's right.
So he and I rattled around New South Wales to different distances from a transmitter and made lots of observations. I did that for a couple of years. And the data that we had accumulated disappeared one day. I had books full of data, so no paper was ever written on that. I expended 2 years of my scientific life, and all the data disappeared.
Could you be a little more explicit about disappeared? Stolen? Taken by the trash man?
Well, it sure as hell wasn't taken by the trash man, because we had quite a lot of it distributed around. I don't really believe that explanation, but just how it disappeared, I don't know.
Well, since it's not radio astronomy data, I won't probe any further.
Perhaps in the course
central
of your,
to my story.
Perhaps in the course of your inquiries, you could ask people.
Did you take Ron Bracewell's data in 52, I guess it is?
I think it would have happened in 52.
You see, someone trying to get you off this project.
Well, they got me into radio astronomy. So in 1952,